Support for the California Report comes from the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org. URS, a global engineering and construction firm providing engineering, construction, and technical support to public agencies and private companies. URS.com. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, 15 seconds that jolted the San Francisco Bay Area 25 years ago. How the Loma Prieta earthquake changed life near the epicenter in the Santa Cruz Mountains.
What we designed for is we designed for the first 8. And we're basically giving you time to get out of the structure.
Also, Jewish filmmakers who fled Nazi Germany and the impact they had on Hollywood, and milking it for all it's worth. Inmates working at a prison dairy.
They come in and they haven't really seen a cow before and haven't really milked a cow before.
All that plus a review of the new release by Bay Area blues trio Howl Divine. It's the California Report. We begin today with the 25th anniversary of a day few living in the San Francisco Bay Area will ever forget. October 17, 1989, at 5:04 p.m., a 6.9 earthquake changed everything.
Well, the Oakland A's take.
I'll tell you what, we're having an earthquake.
911 emergency.
Yes, have you gotten word about the Bay Bridge?
What about the Bay Bridge? What's wrong with it?
The upper deck appears to have collapsed during that earthquake.
Hold on a second.
The whole section of the overhead just collapsed. Overhead.
Our cyberstructure in Oakland has just fallen through.
We'll check the ambulance responses 3-2 in Cypress.
The Loma Prieta quake killed 63 people, most of them crushed in their cars when a double-deck freeway in Oakland collapsed. International media, in town for Game 3 of the World Series at Candlestick Park, pivoted to cover the damage. Their focus was telegenic San Francisco and the devastated Nimitz Freeway in Oakland, but it was also chaotic in cities and towns closest to the epicenter.
People, move away, please!
Buildings in downtown Los Gatos and Santa Cruz crumbled.
There's lots of rubble everywhere.
In Watsonville, just north of the Monterey County line, migrant farmers were forced to live in tents in the center of town. For days, the magnitude of destruction near the remote epicenter in the Santa Cruz Mountains was overlooked. KQED's Silicon Valley news editor Beth Willon was living there at the time and lost her home. 25 years later, she returned to her old neighborhood to bring us a story about the quake's lasting impact on the way homes are built today.
Mount Loma Prieta in the Santa Cruz Mountains, the epicenter, the spot where it all began on the night of October 17, 1989. Kevin Zaknich was eating a piping hot bowl of his mother's goulash watching the World Series. At 5:04, there was a massive jolt. 15 seconds of terror followed, forever changing the way most of us in California look at earthquakes.
It sounded like a freight train, but it's too simple. It just was a loud moaning, it rattled you to your soul. It was crazy.
And it was devastating. 11 miles below the surface, the San Andreas Fault released hundreds of years of geological pressure. It ripped apart roads, triggered landslides, and made propane tanks explode. Zaknich's home was destroyed, and so was mine. My family and I lost just about everything inside, but we were away when the quake hit and watched it play out on a television screen in Sonoma County.
We're not sure. We're trying to find out right now exactly how strong the quake was and find out its epicenter. We have been scrambling around. Excuse me if I'm just a little bit out of breath.
Like mine, Zaknich's home was not bolted down well enough to withstand a 6.9 quake.
A small little log cabin on pier blocks came off the pier blocks slash foundation, a deck split from the house, an addition split from the house.
And so a lot of these homes were just lurched off their foundations.
In the quake's aftermath, geotechnical engineer Patrick Shires handled close to 1,000 damaged homes for Santa Cruz County.
There were cases where there were homes that were built without any kind of permitting activity going on, and so they were not to any code.
It was much more of a free-for-all. I've seen, you know, little hand sketches of an addition. That's what was submitted, and that's what was okayed.
Structural engineer Carolyn Scott says Loma Prieta was a wake-up call. After tightening home building codes, she says today Santa Cruz, Santa Clara, and San Francisco counties now have the strictest regulations in Northern California for things like bolting and addition connections. The new homes, she says, are prepared for a quake as big as an 8.0.
What we design for is we design for the first 8. And we're basically giving you time to get out of the structure.
One of the biggest and most expensive changes, soil testing. Patrick Shire says soil tests must be done to see if there's a landslide risk and how deep a foundation is needed.
You're doing the analyses and then writing the report that contains all those analyses. So it's thousands of dollars.
The stricter building codes, Kevin Zaknich says, along with all the Silicon Valley money coming in, had a big impact on his neighborhood.
The earthquake changed it dramatically. I mean, a lot of the houses went from funky little cabins to wealthy, luxurious homes now.
It took his family 2 years to rebuild their home. Today he works on the mountain where he grew up, but he lives in Santa Cruz.
If there is another quake, I hope I'm on the beach somewhere and it's nice and flat and I don't see any redwoods.
He says one major earthquake in his lifetime is quite enough. As for me, I moved to the flatlands too. For the California Report, I'm Beth Willon in the Santa Cruz Mountains.
For sure, there's more to be done with seismic upgrades, but Keith Knutson with the U.S. Geological Survey believes that with $22 billion spent on infrastructure upgrades since Loma Prieta, the Bay Area is earthquake ready.
All the utilities from our power and energy, they've retrofitted their facilities, they've strengthened their pipelines, they've added redundancy, they're more resilient. The water agencies are actively working to make their structures more resilient.
Of course, it's great to make buildings safer and stronger, but what happens after a huge disaster when the things you rely on every day, power, water, police, and fire, are overwhelmed or unavailable? Then what?
That's it, I'm off. You're off? Wait for freedom?
As a new class of recruits went through training exercises at Fire Station 7 in San Francisco this week, I sat down with Lieutenant Erica Artaceros. She oversees the city's neighborhood emergency response teams. I asked her, what's the biggest obstacle to convincing us to prepare for the big one?
I think people have their own built-in fears. They have time constraints. They have other priorities. It's not something that we experience often, where in Florida they prepare for hurricanes and they generally happen. So, you know, there's kind of some satisfaction in it.
What can you learn from an earthquake like the one most recently in Napa?
Well, I think one of the things that we learned is that on a smaller scale, it had the impacts that we expect. Water lines that broke, a fire after earthquake. And so we are on the right track with what we train people to prepare for. One of the misnomers is that everybody has to evacuate after an earthquake. It's not so. You do need to evacuate if there's a fire, but we want to encourage people to plan to stay in place after an earthquake.
Most importantly, she says, make a plan to communicate with your loved ones, have necessities like water in a place you can get them, like your car trunk, and organize with people nearby through a neighborhood emergency response team.
This hot sauce is in my bloodstream.
I feel like I have a little better perspective on what it really means to be hungry.
We are the almond capital of the world.
The stereotypical job for prison inmates is making license plates. But the reality for some inmates in the Central Valley couldn't be more different. Their workplace, a dairy, where they produce milk for almost all the state's prisons. For the series California Foodways, Lisa Morehouse talks to inmates who say the job gives them much more than a small paycheck.
First things first, you're not going to hear any cows mooing in this story. That's because I've learned cows moo when they're hungry or agitated or in pain. If quiet cows are happy cows, then these cows at Corcoran State Prison seem pretty happy. Jose Franco and some colleagues move 20 cows into a milking building. Wearing a prison jumpsuit, Franco stands in a kind of trough below two rows of cows, their udders easily within reach.
I dip them with iodine and wipe them before I put the pumps on.
To make sure they're clean.
Put one pump on each udder. We milk close to 300 cows a day. I like it. Milking them, going out there to get them, bringing them in.
There's been a dairy on this land since the 1950s, decades before the prison was built. It sits on 30 acres of prison grounds outside the secure perimeter. Only inmates with the lowest security risk can work here. Even though he's only assigned to work 5 days a week, Franco says he's here every day.
I like coming out here to be away from the people in there, in the yard.
He earns 65 cents an hour, better than most jobs in prison. Franco's in for vehicle theft. He's never had a job around animals or agriculture before. And that's typical, says Rob Roque, who oversees the dairy and milk processing programs here at Corcoran.
They come in and they haven't really seen a cow before and haven't really milked a cow before.
As we walk through a barn of milking cows, Roque tells me most inmates come from cities.
And the other thing that's typical is that we usually don't get workers out here that have any work skills, usually. Some will come to us with construction.
Like Jose Franco.
Some of them will come to us with heavy equipment, and then we just build on it.
The California Prison Industry Authority is part of the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, but it runs like a separate business, selling products like this milk to state agencies. Inmates hold lots of different jobs, but prison industries employees are a select group. Of California's 116,000 inmates, just under 7,000 get these jobs, including coffee roasting and almond farming. For Rob Roque, running a dairy in a prison is a little different than the private sector.
My father and my grandfather had a dairy, and we're in the dairy business.
He says he's only rarely had to deal with violence, but if there's a whole prison lockdown...
Cows don't wait. If you don't have workers, they don't wait to be milked or fed.
Non-inmate staff take up the slack. There are other issues, keeping a lookout for smuggled cell phones and doing hourly inmate headcounts. Inmates have escaped from the dairy, though they've all been quickly caught.
But our payoff as an organization is to employ inmates and teach them a job skill so that when they are released, they can get out there and sustain a living.
But Prison Industries doesn't collect employment data on former inmates, so we don't know how many get jobs when they're released or if they're employed in the field they worked in while incarcerated. The agency reports that their former inmate employees return to prison about 30% less than the general prison population, though it's a little hard to compare since these workers are carefully selected in the first place. I have to pass through the prison's secure perimeter to get to the milk processing facility, where huge tankers deliver milk from the dairy.
I'm the laboratory guy. I test all the milk for bacteria and enzymes and things of that nature.
That's where I meet Edward Wilson. He's handpicked out of a crew of 17 men to give me a tour. He doesn't talk about recidivism rates and employment data. He's confident his experience here will get him a job on the outside. Wilson's earned a number of licenses in prison to do this job. He's from the Central Valley town of Hemet.
There's a lot of dairies and things down there.
And he says he'll look for similar work when he gets released in 2017. With a half dozen supervisors, guards, and public information officers surrounding us, Wilson says,
hopefully I get a good recommendation, and it's a good job. I really enjoy what I do. I consume the milk, and I wouldn't want to send out milk that's not good for consumption. I take pride in what I do.
And that's kind of new for Wilson, who's in for second-degree attempted murder.
I've never been actually involved in anything like this, but I would really like to pursue it back in society. Not just for this job, but it just shows you what you're capable of in any kind of job.
His colleague, Ryan Mons, holds a pasteurizing license, and he takes up the milk processing tour from here.
This guy makes sure it's good, and then if he gives me the okay, I pasteurize the milk, cook it, make sure everything's good, the temperature's good, and make sure we can run it through our tanks and we can pack it.
A group of inmates works quickly at a machine that packages milk in cartons. According to prison industries, they sell some of this milk to state institutions, like veterans' homes and state hospitals. They also supply a carton of milk a day to almost every inmate in California. I asked Mons, aside from the milk, what are meals like at Chow? In a word, he says, small.
You don't starve. Yeah, they got a store here. You can go to the store and buy food. Plus, if you work back here, you can drink milk all day. Chocolate milk, whole milk.
Aside from staying off the yard, Mon says working here helps him pay restitution and save a little money for when he's released this December after doing time for grand theft. What does he think it would take for him to get a job like this on the outside?
I got to go down there and apply and let them know how I work. You know, apply my effort. You know, show them that I can do it.
He's hoping an employer will give him a chance based on his 2 years of experience at this milk processing plant. For the California Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse at Corcoran State Prison.
Lisa's next story in the California Foodways series will make you feel jittery about an experimental crop being grown in Santa Barbara County. In the 1930s, as the National Socialist Party gained power in Germany, people around the world did what they could to help Jews escape the Nazi threat. Many Jewish filmmakers and producers found refuge in Hollywood, and their contributions forever changed American cinema and culture. Those stories are told in several new museum exhibits across Los Angeles. From KCRW, Avishai Artsy has more.
I love you so much. And I hate this war so much.
The 1942 film classic Casablanca starred Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman, set amidst the backdrop of World War II. Bogart owns Rick's Cafe, a popular nightclub where German refugees hang out, waiting for exit visas to escape to America.
And wherever I'll be, I want you to know that.
It's as much as an exile film as it is a romantic drama.
That's Doris Berger, curator of a new exhibit called Light and Noir, Exiles and Emigres in Hollywood, 1933 to 1950. It's at the Skirball Cultural Center in Los Angeles.
And in Rick's Cafe, where everyone comes to, but then has to leave and has to go someplace else. So it's this transitory space in itself.
Not to mention that most of the actors were themselves immigrants. Casablanca is among the better-known films included in the exhibit. It begins with the rise of Nazis in Germany and ends with the U.S. anti-communist hearings and the Hollywood blacklist. And it tells the story using film footage, photographs, props, costumes, memorabilia. There's even furniture from the set of Rick's Cafe in Casablanca. Jews held prominent positions in Germany's film industry before the Nazis came to power. Films like The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and Metropolis used strange camera angles, dark shadows, and mystical figures. Those German expressionist films of the 1920s are celebrated in another show, Haunted Screens, at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. The shows weren't planned together, but LACMA curator Britt Salveson says her show provides a preface to the Skirball exhibit.
One of the films we feature with some drawings and photographs and posters is The Blue Angel, which was one of Marlene Dietrich's breakout roles, directed by von Sternberg. And they both emigrated to Hollywood shortly after that film was made.
Falling in love again, never wanted. What's a girl to do? Can't help it.
Jews who lived in Hollywood established funds to secure visas and jobs for the emigres. During the war, some 800 German-speaking Jews arrived in Hollywood. Tailors, prop designers, writers, composers, and major directors like Fritz Lang and Billy Wilder. Those new arrivals created new genres, film noir and the anti-Nazi movie. The first major studio picture came in 1939 with Confessions of a Nazi Spy.
We have instructions for you, Grützweit. You are going back to Germany.
Why?
Your actions have become much too dangerous for you to remain here.
We are still in America. I didn't mean anything wrong. Please, I don't want to go back to Germany. I don't want to go back to Germany. I don't want to go back to Germany.
A strange irony of the émigré story is that the few roles available for German immigrant actors because of their strong accents were as Nazi soldiers. Martin Kosleck made a career out of it. He played Joseph Goebbels, Hitler's propaganda minister, 5 times.
I am their father. My Führer, your position as our true spiritual leader is unquestionable. But don't you think it may be a bit premature to incur the antagonism of religious groups? Antagonism!
Hollywood, which has always been a vehicle for exporting American culture, became a way for Jewish immigrants to project their own outlook of the world and the psychological toll of the war. Jan Christopher Horak is the director of the UCLA Film and Television Archive.
Hollywood films, until World War II, are still very optimistic and positive, and you don't get the kind of ambiguous characters, you don't get these shades of gray between good and evil that you do suddenly find in these film noirs.
The impact of émigré Jews didn't stop in 1950. A second exhibit at the Skirball, The Noir Effect, examines the influence of film noir on American culture, from films like Ridley Scott's Blade Runner and David Lynch's Mulholland Drive, to photographer Cindy Sherman, painter Ed Ruscha, and the imagery of graphic novels, children's books, and video games like L.A. Noir.
The city of dreams, where Hollywood will shape the thoughts and desires of the entire planet.
It's further proof that the legacy of Hollywood's Jewish émigrés continues decades later. The Skirball exhibit runs through March. The LACMA show is up through April. For the California Report, I'm Avishai Artsy in Los Angeles.
In the 1960s, rock impresario Bill Graham introduced the electrified Chicago blues sound to Bay Area audiences when he started presenting these artists on the same bill as rock bands. But there was an older Mississippi Delta blues tradition already in place, an acoustic sound that provides the primary inspiration for the band Howl Divine. Music critic Andrew Gilbert reviews Modern Sounds of Ancient Juju, a new album that harkens back to the blues' rural roots.
As a name for a blues combo, Howl Divine is almost too perfect. But Joshua Howl and Pete Divine come by their moniker and their irresistibly rootsy Delta sound, honestly.
I'm gonna wait to leave you. I won't be back tomorrow. I'm going back down south. Child, don't you wanna go? Baby, I was trouble. I was all.
The band has become one of the Bay Area's busiest blues combos since the release last year of their debut album, Jumps, Boogies, and Wobbles. It was the first blues album in almost 3 decades released by Arhuli, the storied East Bay Roots label founded by Chris Strachwitz. Howl Divine's new album, Modern Sounds of Ancient Juju, makes it even more clear why Strachwitz, who recorded classic albums by the likes of Lightnin' Hopkins, Mance Lipscomb, and Fred McDowell, was struck by the band's juke joint grooves. With Howl on slide guitar, harmonica, and urgent yet laid-back vocals, and the loose but lockstep rhythm section of bassist Joe Kyle Jr. and Divine on stripped-down drum kit and occasional washboard, the band boasts an open, uncluttered sound that taps into the blues roots without sounding like mimicry. And what makes Howl Divine's music so engaging is the way they combine their command of the acoustic idiom with an awareness of the entire blues continuum. The effect can be revealingly uncanny, like when they tear into Bucca White's Shake 'Em On Down, and it sounds like a lost, unplugged side from Jimi Hendrix, circa 1967.
Well, if you come to my house and find me around, come in now, woman, and we'll just shake 'em on down to my starler. Believe I'll shake 'em on down.
Part of the album's fun is the way it mixes vintage tunes by long-departed blues legends with Howell Devine originals.
She walked in that morning, the doctor said he was dead. People start walking out crying and shaking their head. That's what his mother said. She stayed there 24 long hours. Brought life back to the dead.
They follow that gem by Sonny Boy Williamson II with this piece by Howell. Howell learned the blues ropes in the early 90s as a teenager sitting in at Oakland joints like Eli's Mile High Club. After earning a degree in philosophy from UC Santa Cruz, he went on to apprentice with Arkansas-born country blues master Robert Lowry.
Well, the blood in your veins today is running cold, but tomorrow you'll be calling me, warming up my soul.
Devine got his start in the late 80s with Bo Grumpus, a band with a vast repertoire of rags, stomps, marches, and early jazz numbers. More recently, he's played jump blues, gypsy jazz, and led his own jug band. He and Howell met about 4 years ago, playing at a Mission District club, and ever since they've been honing a sound that brings the blues back to the front porch. Modern Sounds of Ancient Juju closes with a smokin' live track. The tune evokes the Railroads, which played such a big role in the music's evolution, and led to the eclipse of the country blues that Howell Devine plays so well.
Andrew Gilbert is a Bay Area writer who covers jazz and world music. He reviewed Howell Devine's Modern Sounds of Ancient Juju. And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Susie Rocho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman and Danny Bringer. The online team includes David Weir, Lisa Pickoff-White, Adam Grossberg, Don Clyde, and David Marks. Our interns are Adiza Egan and Isaac Silk. The California Report's editorial team includes Victoria Malione, Holly Stryker, Ingrid Becker, Bruce Kuhn, and Holly Kernan. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
California Foodways is made possible with support from Cal Humanities, a nonprofit partner of the NEH. Visit www.calhum.org. Support for the California Report comes from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. And the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of California's children.